I am to talk tonight on the impact which the release of atomic energy has had on the contemporary world. I wish that this were a subject in science and that I could talk to you as a physicist. I wish that, like your past speakers, I could talk of something which is my knowledge and my vocation. But the problem of atomic energy is not a scientific problem, the discoveries of which you heard in the first lecture from Professor Macmillan are interesting, but they pose almost no serious scientific questions. These discoveries I may enumerate. They are, first of all, that the heaviest elements can be caused to come apart under neutron bombardment, and that the release of energy when this happens is about 100 million times as great as the energy release in a chemical reaction. Second, that when this process of fission takes place, neutrons are emitted, more than one. And third, that there are materials of which the new transuranic element plutonium and two isotopes of uranium, 235 and 233, are the most important, in which these neutrons are used efficiently enough to produce further fissions, so that one can, in these materials, have a chain reaction which diverges and which can either be used for the generation of power or for the generation of an explosive, an explosion. There are many other things. There is the all-important fact that only two materials found in nature, uranium and thorium, can be used as a starting point for this activity, and that there is nothing in current physics to suggest that other materials will ever be used, other raw materials. There is a good deal to suggest that that will not be the case. There is the all-important fact that ordinary uranium, as you dig it up out of the ground, cannot be used for an atomic explosive, but it can be used to make a chain reaction and has been so used by the device of slowing or moderating the neutrons and so making the rare isotope of uranium effective in maintaining the chain. The fact that the problem posed by the release of atomic energy is not scientific does not mean that technical matters are not relevant to it. In fact, I will try tonight to show that it is only by coming back again and again to the elementary technical facts that one can make any sense of it. But if I speak of it tonight, it is primarily because it is perhaps not a problem of contemporary society, but the cardinal problem of contemporary society. And it is because I have seen how an acquaintance with the realities, an acquaintance with the facts, has led group after group to a way of thinking which I think is sound, which I wish to lay before you tonight. The history of this goes back to long before Hiroshima. In Los Alamos, as I am sure in all other laboratories that were engaged in this work, the men of science who came from different countries and were very different kinds of people did have in common two things: a belief in the faith, a faith in the value of their science, and a deep, unshatterable hope that some good would come of the work they were doing. But they had very little else to go on, because what they were doing was rather a disagreeable thing. They were making a very bad weapon. And often in small groups, we talked about what might come of this and along what lines a constructive and reasonable and heartening solution might be found. And when the matter came into the open, the technical people who were close to the knowledge of atomic energy were the first, I think, to realize the lines along which our country and the world must try to move. But I've sat with many groups, and I know that there are many others with whom I have not sat, with the Secretary of War's Committee, with the Secretary of State's Committee, with the consultants to the Secretary of State, with the Special Committee of the Senate, with the United States Representative to the Atomic Energy Commission, and finally with the technical people on the Atomic Energy Commission representing the 12 different countries who are participating. And in every case, I found that when you got into it, when you really started talking about what atomic energy was and what it was like, the elements of a sensible way of proceeding emerged. And I cannot help feeling that the experience of thinking these things through is one which most of the people of this country cannot afford to go without. So I'm going to talk to you tonight, fully aware of the fact that I'm going way beyond my competence as a scientist, to call to your attention what is the history of United States policy in these matters. Not that I am convinced that at every point the policy is right, not that I would feel that anyone could be so convinced, but that I feel that the arguments that have led to it are sound arguments and will have to be brought to bear in the future. Well, now, as I've said, these discoveries of fission and many secondary ones, which may be called the tricks of the trade, how you make a pile work, how you make a bomb work, these are not things which present very interesting scientific problems. One may ask what sort of practical development they may lead to. And you've had an answer to that question from your last four lecturers. There are two main lines which from the first have been apparent, and each of which leads off into a future that is dim because we're not smart enough, wise enough to see. It is a little bit, as everyone has said, like the discovery of electromagnetic induction by Faraday. No one at that time could have thought that out of this discovery would come the electrical age. It is unlike the discovery of electromagnetic induction because that, as physics, was much more interesting and led to much more wonderful things. But if we had only the problem of developing power from sources of atomic energy, that would be a tough problem because there are problems of chemical and nuclear engineering. There are the problems of how to design a reactor, a pile, so that it be a convenient size, so that it be economical of the valuable materials, plutonium, enriched uranium, so that it ultimately be economical of the raw materials and get as much power per ton out of uranium and thorium as possible, of designing these reactors so they were flexible and adaptable and could be put on a pleasure boat or a battleship, so that they could be used at the North Pole, so that they would be in every way convenient. These are tough problems. They are on their way to solution, and you can be quite sure that they will be solved. But they are not solved today. If it were only for that, we would have a more or less familiar situation. Similarly, and even more so, with the application of radiations and radioactivities, of tracers, and the direct use of neutrons and gamma rays. This is something which would take care of itself if you made available the radiations, the radioactive materials, and the information in time, first the universities and the medical schools, and finally the industries and the manufacturers of drugs and God knows who all would learn to use these things. And the pattern for the development of atomic energy would be a very simple one if it had come into a world simply as a vehicle of these possible remote, but not so remote, improvements in the standard of life and in our control over nature and our ability to do things. Then one would have let it go more or less according to the custom of the country. No doubt in the United States, most of the research would have been done in universities, most of the application by industry. There might have been some government laboratories working on it, and there might not. In Russia, no doubt, it would have been made a state monopoly, and in France and Britain, I suppose it would too, and there would have been some argument about it. Well, the reason why this has not happened, and this was, after all, the pattern by which the developments of electromagnetism were followed. The reason why this has not happened is one trivial one and one very serious one. And, of course, what I'm saying you can guess ahead of time. The trivial reason is that these developments were pushed with a really fantastic speed during the war under the auspices of the government of the United States, and that the government found itself in possession of know-how, experience, technical information, stacks and stacks of secret documents, enough to use for the housing shortage, if you'd be willing to live in paper, people who are trained, installations, bombs, active material, factories, all sorts of things. And that the government was therefore faced with an unprecedented question, what should we do with this? That is, there was a choice offered because of the unnatural way, the sudden, unnatural, forced, secret way in which this development had taken place. But even that would not be the essential point if it had not been for the really essential point, which was that the first manifestation of atomic energy in the world was not as new power, new medicines, new knowledge, new health, but as a weapon of war, and a very grim one. That weapon of war, used at the end of the war with Japan, came into a world singularly ripe for such trouble. Namely, it came into a world which twice in 25 years had lived through terrible slaughter, and in which in this last fight everyone had become aware of the almost intolerable conditions which modern warfare, which total warfare, imposed on mankind. All over the world, people were looking for methods to ensure the peace. All over the world, people were looking for methods to unite the world. And at the same time, and just as a characteristic of the time, the world was sharply divided. It, to you who may remember the history of the last 15 years, was by no means a foregone conclusion, by no means a certain thing, that the Allies who successfully fought the Axis would be able to unite to fight the Axis. It was not even certain that they could remain united to complete that war. And therefore, the advent of atomic weapons, among other things, came upon a world in desperate need of peace and very far from the political preconditions for peace. This is one reason why atomic bombs are important, and it has nothing to do with fission. The other thing, of course, is that partly by hard work and partly by good luck, the first weapons that were made gave some adequate foretaste of what atomic warfare would be like, and even to a world rather saturated with horror, added a note of increased apprehension. In other words, they worked. And it was quite easy to see from the fact that the United States, in concert with Britain, had used such weapons against an enemy which was essentially defeated, had used such weapons when not the outcome, but only the time of the outcome of a war was already fixed. From that fact, and from the high regard which we rightly have for our degree of civilization, it could be inferred that such weapons would always be used if there were war again, and if the people who were fighting happened to have them. That dispelled of one illusion, namely, that you could have a world full of these things, or a world full of the capacity to make them, and still hope to get by without them. Well, then there were three arguments, and they are very familiar to you, which were immediately brought forward to throw some light on the nature of the military problem created by this. And these were all negative arguments. They were all arguments of horror, and I am somewhat reluctant to belabor them, but they played in the history of our policy a decisive part, and it is my view that they will always play that part. The first was that they were terrible weapons, that you could make a lot of them, that it was by no means ambitious to think of making 5,000 or 10,000 atomic bombs, that they were cheap, that it would cost very much less to do this than to maintain even a second-rate navy, that the cost of the destruction of cities and industries and people had gone down as a result of this development by a large factor, a significant factor, let us say 30 or 40-fold. You could, with very little, relatively very little effort, take out all the major cities of an enemy. you could, with relatively little effort, kill a very large fraction, a fraction not known in modern war, of his people. And that these things were immediately there, that it was not a question of pursuing recondite new developments. And I can only record my conviction that these conclusions are sound, that if you want 5,000 atomic bombs and are willing to pay a very small price, you can have them, and that they will do what they are reputed to do. And this notion that this was a revolutionary upswing in the destructiveness of modern warfare and a sort of parody of the whole notion of total war, this was the first thing that hit people between the eyes. Well, don't forget it. It is possible to set off an atomic bomb in such a way, in such a place, that it does no damage. But that is only if there are no people around. And the second thing was that when one examined the possibility of providing adequate defenses against a war in which both combatants would use such weapons, one came upon a rather horrifying thought. Because in the first place, it is clear that if you have cut down the cost of destruction by a factor of 30, the interception of 20% of the missiles won't do you much good. 20% was very good. In fact, it's unheard of good for interception of strategic bombardment in the last war. But this brought up another thing. Namely, people said, well, however good your defenses are, they will not be very good unless they are alerted. And the notion that atomic bombs would be a superb weapon for use without warning for the devastation of cities began to take hold of people and to worry them a little bit. And at that stage, people also pointed out that you could bring atomic bombs into, let us say, Washington, if that happens to be the town that you think is central to the welfare of the United States, and plant it someplace, and it may be set off as a mine, that things are sufficiently compact and sufficiently devastating so that you can afford to take the necessary trouble to be sure that such weapons get where you want them to do the maximum damage. And this notion that the surprise use of atomic weapons might be one of the things to worry about most has had a great effect on all subsequent thinking. Well, the third point was the following. It might be disturbing to people in other countries if we had lots of atomic bombs, but if they didn't, it wouldn't be disturbing to us. And therefore the question arose, is there any chance that we may hold on to the monopoly that we at the present moment enjoy? Well, a lot of nonsense was talked about that. People said, well, give any good country 6 months and they will produce atomic bombs, and after all, there's nothing to it. None of this is true. It was a quite hard job. It put a manifest strain on a very effective industry, namely the United States industry. It put a manifest strain even on our scientists, but most of whom worked long hours, and not most of whom, but a very great fraction of whom worked long hours in great apprehension for fear the thing wouldn't come through. And it's not the sort of thing that you can expect overnight. But the point is that American science is maybe a little more numerous than other science, but it is certainly not very different. The science is universal, and the techniques of science are universal. The point is that American industry is further along than industry in other countries, but it is not of a different general quality. Industry is simply an expression of man's universal desire to improve his standard of living and to lift himself above savagery. And it is absurd to think that the United States has a monopoly on that. Science is just a universal expression of man's desire to understand the world in which he is living. And it thrives on communication. And United States science wouldn't amount to much if it had no contact with that of Europe. So that it was manifest that there was no permanent monopoly that could be expected, that it might be difficult to estimate how long a period before there would be atomic bombs in other countries in the world, but that this would come about for sure. And that one was therefore faced with a qualitative upswing in the ferocity of warfare, with an upswing against which there would be no adequate defense, and with weapons which we could not permanently enjoy the monopoly of, if you want to call it enjoy. Not only that, but just the fact that the surprise use of weapons, of such weapons, appeared to offer such great advantages, and the traditional openness of this country, and also its traditional difficulty about organizing itself for war, something of which I'm very proud, and finally, its fantastic concentration of industry and population would make it peculiarly vulnerable, and that the atomic bomb which we had gone and developed might at the moment, might in the last war, be something which rendered the United States stronger, but which in the long term, unless proper use were made of this opportunity, would make it weaker. It was in recognition of these facts, and of others no doubt, that the President of the United States, last October, committed us to the internationalization of atomic energy in very vague terms, in terms whose vagueness does him great credit, because it was hard to make them precise without making them wrong. But in his message to Congress, he said that this was too revolutionary a force to be handled in conventional terms, that he proposed to discuss with the other nations the possible methods of seeing to it that it was used only for the benefit of mankind and not its destruction. That was the beginning, and very, very soon thereafter, there were three declarations, more or less identical in substance, which gave more body to these proposals. One was the agreed declaration of the Prime Ministers of Canada and Great Britain and the President of the United States. One was the Moscow Declaration of the Foreign Ministers the Foreign Minister of Great Britain, the Commissar of Foreign Affairs of the Soviet Union, and the Secretary of State of the United States. And the final document was the Assembly Resolution in January calling upon the Atomic Energy Commission to get busy and do something. And it is worth thinking what the elements were in these declarations which went beyond what the President had said, because they throw great light on what the nature of the problem was then conceived to be. In the first place, the declaration started out with the frank statement that the only secure protection against the destructive uses of scientific advances was the elimination of war. And this laid down a boundary condition for anything that was to be done about atomic energy, that it must be a step in the elimination of war, that it must lead in that direction and not toward warfare. The second point was that the idea of a purely formal agreement of the type of the Locarno Convention to simply say one would not make atomic weapons nor use them would not be adequate, because the documents all called for effective safeguards to protect complying states against the hazards of evasions and violations. And so the general thing which was taking shape, and which was left quite general, was that there should be an exchange of a maximum exchange of scientific information, an optimal prosecution of the beneficial uses of atomic energy, set of safeguards of some kind left extremely vague to see that no harm was done, and that all of this should somehow be used in a way to promote the avoidance of war. Well, this last point is a very serious one when you think that not only is the UN machinery itself a rather slight safeguard for the avoidance of war, but when you think that the unrestrained rivalry in the development of atomic energy and atomic weapons would itself be a source of war. There will be rivalry, there would be rivalry, and there no doubt is, for the raw materials. They are quite abundant, but there are places where they are easy to get, and most places they are very hard. And uranium is a much more important thing for the future life of a country than oil has been for its past life. There will be rivalry for the development of atomic energy.
because although in the long term this development will be worldwide, in any one country it will surge ahead for a while and then fall behind. At least that's the normal thing to expect. And every country will be anxious to be sure that it is permanently on top of the heap. There will be even rivalry for the possession of such poor things as physicists. There is such rivalry today, and it's a very odd sight indeed. And the notion that one could allow the uncontrolled exploitation of weapons as serious as this, and of the industry that goes to their making, without promoting a situation in which warfare was likely to break out in order to overcome the intolerable tensions of this, this did not seem very reasonable. And so for all these reasons, the focus of the problem of atomic energy returned to this: what can one do to attempt, in controlling atomic energy, to reduce the probability of war, to reduce it, or if possible, to abolish it. In the light of that, the existing proposals, or the proposals which had been much discussed at that time, looked rather pathetic. They were three: the proposal of a convention, the meaning of that simply a treaty in which you say you will use atomic energy only for good things. Second, the proposal of sanctions for anyone who violated the convention. And third, the proposal of regulation in the form of international inspection. Let us look briefly at what these are. Well, as far as the convention goes, this, like the other two, is made particularly hopeless because of the widespread parallelism between the activities which are necessary for the development of atomic energy, for industry, for power, and the activities which lead to the making of atomic weapons. I'll come back to this, but by and large one can say the following. You cannot have an atomic energy industry without having plants which either are making or which probably could make, or which could make with a very minor change, material which you can just use in bombs. You cannot have a healthy atomic energy industry without great stockpiles of stuff which either is suitable atomic explosive or which rapidly can be made into it, or fairly rapidly can be made into it. And therefore, you've very largely broken the back of the problem of having, oh, let's say, 1,000 atomic bombs if you're engaged in the atomic power business. And this means that quite apart from the notorious unreliability of conventions and the fact that they've been broken over and over again in the history of the world, this convention would be particularly vulnerable because people would be all the time skirting the surface between what was allowed by the convention and what was not allowed. And because there would be every incentive, legitimate and illegitimate, to develop an atomic energy industry as a potential source of atomic weapons, and all you would have to say is, well, we need the power. Just look, we're using it all. The strain which this sort of arrangement would put on the world does not seem to me any less than the strain that would exist if the convention were not there at all, although I myself am for having such a convention as a part of a much larger scheme. The second proposal was to say, well, perhaps we can make it simply very unappetizing to use atomic bombs. Let us, for instance, take some number, 100 or 200, and let us provide the United Nations, which has armed forces on paper, if not in reality, with a stock of bombs of this kind. Then if anybody gets fresh and starts using these things, why, the United Nations will go off and bomb them. Well, this argument, I think, also has very little in it, and for this proposal, and for a number of reasons. In the first place, the idea of having some regulation of atomic energy is not that you can bang back good and hard if somebody does it, but that you will prevent him from ever getting there. It is prevention and not retaliation. But more important even than this is the following. Here would be these 200 bombs, and they would be painted with the colors of the United Nations. But they would be someplace. And it is clear that the whole problem, that there is no effective machinery for international action in the world, I mean for genuinely international action, is elucidated by the fact that there is no guarantee that these weapons would not be stolen by some country in whose territory they happen to be or through whose territory they happen to pass. And finally, you are up against the fact that wars would not break out if it were certain that any transgressor nation or aggressor nation was going to be ganged up on by overwhelming force. The reason why wars break out, or one of the many reasons why wars do in fact break out, is because this is not so clear, because there appears to be a reasonable chance that the nation engaging in the aggression, and not all wars start in such a clear-cut way, that that nation has a chance of winning. And it is precisely because it fails to take account of these things that the notion of sanctions without anything else looks hopeless. And the final notion, that of regulation, also has a valid part to play in any scheme for the control of atomic energy. That notion is the following, that you would leave the activities of atomic energy in the hands, well, in the United States, of the Atomic Energy Commission and the industries and universities that it licensed, in Russia to their Atomic Energy Commission, in France to their High Commission of Atomic Energy. But you would then try to organize some sort of group of policemen who would go around and have a look and see that nothing illicit was being done. They would be called inspectors, and their purpose would be to find out that if a plant was supposed to be making power and not bombs, it was in fact making power and not bombs. That if there was supposed to be no mining going on in a certain area, there was in fact no mining going on in a certain area. That if a mine was open in another place and they said that 300 tons was coming out of it per year, that that was all that was coming out, 200 was not being hidden somewhere. Well, the State Department Committee and many other people have brooded about the possibility of such an outfit, such an inspection outfit, and come pretty clearly to the conclusion that it would just be chasing its shadow. It wouldn't know where to look, and it wouldn't know what to look for. One of the reasons is that this is a living art and a changing one, and people are pretty smart. And if the inspectors got wise enough to look for one kind of plant, why, then you'd go and invent another kind of plant. In the first place, there are a lot of mines in the world, and it's a very dreary business to go into 999 and get the answer, no, there's no uranium, just to go into the 1,000th and find out what you knew all along, that there was some. It's a very dreary business to read the books of thousands of mining companies certifying that they have produced so and so many pounds of uranium per month. It is a very, very dreary business to go into a laboratory and here you are, some inspector that got a job because you were down and out and you never have seen a physics laboratory before. And you go in there and the man says, oh no, we're working on pure physics. And you look around and you can't figure out whether he is or not. This sort of thing is hopeless. And these three things, regulation in the form of inspection, sanctions to minimize the attraction of violations, and conventions which at least make it illegal to use atomic bombs, they are all needed, but they are just a very small part of what is needed. Because in all of this, people had failed to take into account the fundamental fact in this field. Two fundamental facts, let me mention them. One is that the very interrelation between the constructive and destructive uses of atomic energy, the technical interrelation, gives you the means by which to control atomic energy and gives you the ability to construct, in a world in which it does not now exist, political and human machinery for a genuine internationalization. And the second point is that if you do this, the authority that is entrusted with it, which we call the Atomic Development Authority, is because of the limited nature of the sources and techniques of atomic energy, not going to be a world government bumping at every point into established traditions and established patterns of life. It is going to have a field to work in which its sources of interference with existing things, with existing patterns, is minimized. And these are the two points which we found the real clue to what looked to us like the right line of a solution. Let me take it again. We thought that the essential thing was not to leave the development of atomic energy in the hands of individual nations or nationals, because they would be bound to have their highest loyalty in the prosecution of work in this field to their own countries. That is only right. And they would be bound by every means possible to make their countries as strong in the sense of atomic armament, as well as in all other senses, as they possibly could and still escape punishment. We thought it was not right to leave in national hands an activity where national rivalry was bound to lead to trouble. We thought it was not right to put all the brains and all the skill and all the incentives and all the positive human motives on the side of the national operators, and then set up some sort of UN police corps, which had neither the brains, nor the skill, nor the incentives, and say, sure, go out and find out what they're doing. Because we knew that they never would find out, and that all they would do was cause an increasing irritation with the United Nations and its increasing discredit. And therefore, we proposed that the one great step be taken of declaring that those key activities in the field of atomic energy, which are dangerous in the sense that they are on the main road from the ore to the bomb, should not be legal for any nation or for any national to undertake, and that a quite new kind of organization be created, a world government limited in scope, but not limited within that scope in power, to handle a problem for which no other solution seemed possible to us. Now, that was the proposal, and it appealed to us because we said, here finally is something for the United Nations policemen to do. They can be engineers and businessmen and physicists and mining people, and they can get to work, and they can get out of atomic energy the things that are in it for the good of the world. And if they do that, they will be close enough to atomic weapons that they will know whether there are any weapons being made, and they'll know how to make them, and they'll know more about the subject than anyone else. But their regulatory functions will be secondary to the functions which they exercise in doing for the good of all mankind something that we all know has to be done. Well, this Atomic Development Authority would have, let me say just briefly, some of its functions. It would have control of uranium and thorium. We would like to say it would own the uranium and thorium, and that is certainly right. There may be cases where, because of the complexities of byproduct operation, that is operation of mines where uranium and thorium are an unimportant byproduct, less rigorous control may be possible. But we thought the Atomic Development Authority must be the one to say that. It must be the one to say what it needs to do in order to be sure that it knows where this stuff is. And remember, these are the only two materials of which there is any reason to believe, any hope to believe, that atomic energy can be developed, only two raw materials. And actually, thorium wouldn't do you any good if you didn't have some uranium or some fissionable material to start with, but one may have. We thought that all of the plants in which plutonium and uranium-233 were produced, and which are also producers of power, and we hope will soon be producers of useful power, should be operated by the authority, should be designed, operated, and planned by the authority. We thought that all separation plants in which uranium-235 is taken out of its less active isotopic partner, uranium-238, should, if there are such plants, and I'm not sure there should be, these should belong to the authority. We thought that there should be research conducted in atomic explosives, because unless you know what you can do in the field, you don't know what you need to do to stop it, and that this was a function that should be reserved exclusively to the Atomic Development Authority. Well, this sounds rather bad in the sense that it looks as though a terrible lot of power was being given to that authority. And that is true, and I'll come back to that point. But we found it very important, just for that reason, to note two ways in which this power was limited. The first is that although atomic energy is an important thing, it is not life itself. There are a lot of other things to mine besides uranium and thorium. And the actual activity in the world today leading toward atomic energy is not a very great one. It's a very specific activity which will grow, but which today you do not find very much interwoven with things like the manufacture of steel or with the manufacture of radios or with the development of drugs or any of those things. And the second point was this. Although a large part of the field of atomic energy, and an indispensable part, is dangerous in the sense that having operations going on in that field, you can readily divert them to the making of atomic weapons, there are lots of other things which are not dangerous at all. Dr. Hamilton is not dangerous. Dr. Stone is not dangerous. And Dr. Seaborg is not very dangerous either. And they are all very busy. And Dr. Perlman might be kept from being dangerous if one only watched him closely enough. Because it is certainly possible to do all the research without any elements of danger. It is certainly possible to use tracers. It is certainly possible to use neutron radiations. And we thought that it would probably be possible to design plants generating power at high level in which a combination of careful accounting, careful design, and the denaturation of the material used in the piles, in the reactors, would combine to make these safe, not for unsupervised operation, but for licensed private operation. To this we attached great importance, to all of these things, because they meant a two-way cognizance between the activities of this international authority and the activities of the scientists, the engineers, the doctors, the businessmen who are not in the authority and who are operating either for their country or for themselves in their country. We thought this important for two reasons. We thought only if the authority was subjected to the kind of healthy criticism that comes when you don't have an absolute monopoly, but people know very much about what you're doing and can think up smart things and say you're not doing it right. Only then would the authority be a healthy thing. Otherwise, it would tend to fossilize and become sort of a bureau after years, and then the danger would start. And second, we thought that the only way you could be sure that the men on the authority knew what was going on in the world is if there were something public and open going on. If the authority were to license a power plant, it would have a lot to do with the design of that plant. If it were to license research, and that I would suppose, if it ever came to be, it would do with practically no conditions. It would certainly wish to know about the research. And the healthy intercourse between international and more or less private, in any case non-international agencies, seemed to us an indispensable corrective to the very great concentration of power implied in such a proposal. Well, now, this proposal of the Atomic Development Authority brings with it the need, as I've said, for powers and for a constitution of this authority very different from what you will find in any international organization today. Because it was our hope, and it is still my hope, that when formed, the personnel of such an authority would not be recruited on a purely national basis. Namely, you would not have an executive committee in which the United States nominated this man, appointed this man, and Britain appointed this man, and so on. But you would have perhaps an elected governing board or elected board of directors in which competence and proved ability would play a very big part. And it was our hope that the personnel of the authority would all the way down the line be recruited with a view to their skill, their interest, their devotion, and their willingness to serve such an outfit, rather as representatives of a specific country. We realized that if one did this, some means would have to be found for being sure that this agency was accountable to the nations which had called it into being. But such things exist. An executive agency of the government is accountable to a congressional committee and ultimately to Congress. And there would be no great difficulty about having a commission composed of the representatives of the various powers, which had certain budgetary and reviewing powers in connection with the work of the authority. That is, there is great difficulty with all of this. There's no great difficulty imagining it. But the essential point is that the authority would have to be free to operate within a rather wide, though well-defined framework, as it saw fit. It would have to be able to decide, this mine is too dangerous. The people whom we have allowed to operate this mine are too timing us, and we must shut it down. We would like to try a new type of reactor. It's true that it's never been done before, and it may blow up, but we'll put it in a place where it won't do any harm. They would have to be free to make administrative decisions involving their program, their development of atomic energy, and even certain punitive actions in the way of revocation of license and shutting down of plants and mines. And all of this would have to be done in accordance with a charter, a bill of particulars, which was agreed to by the nations freely before they got started. And therefore, it seemed clear to us that an authority of this kind, operating within a well-defined mandate, a mandate given them by the nations of the world, but not referring their executive decisions and their policy to the nations of the world unless it went beyond the provisions of their charter. This would be something really very new. This would be the kind of thing that one talks about on a much broader scale when one says world government. But it would be limited here to the specific issues that are involved in atomic energy. And for that reason, we also were aware of the fact that there would be, in such an authority, nothing analogous to the voting rules of the Security Council, because there is no similar problem. The nations would not be represented, and they could not veto. Now, examining what this might be, what kind of security such a plan, if adopted, might lead to, one has to, of course, distinguish two times, the time when it's working, more or less, and the time between now and then when it's coming into being. As for the former time, we did a little thinking about that, and some has gone into the problem since, not very much. But there is one obvious fact. The United States is going to lose its monopoly of atomic weapons anyway. It is sure to do so. I don't know, 10 years from now, 5 years from now. I don't know. But sometime we will be in a world where other people have them and perhaps tell us less about them than we tell them. The most that could possibly happen if during the transition period from the present time to the full operation of an ADA, there were an absolute breakdown and some of the powers pulled out. The worst that could possibly happen is that we would be in the fix that we will be in 5 or 10 years from now anyway. And therefore, one may wish to safeguard this period. One may wish not to put all one's cards on the table before one sees a few of the cards from the other people. But one certainly does not have to fear that one will be worse off if one follows this path. Because the thing that we are doing in the alternative is the thing we fear. And for these two reasons, is this still working? For two reasons. Namely, that the collapse during the transition period to an ADA could not leave us worse off than we will ultimately be. And second, that it cannot take place very rapidly in the nature of things. I don't think one needs to worry too much about the details of that transition. On the other hand, the nature of the security that might be provided were such an ADA to be in existence is worth contemplating. Because in the first place, one would have something amounting to an almost absolute guarantee that nowhere in the world were atomic weapons being made, and that they would not I'm worried about it. And that they would not be made without a very substantial warning. Well, very substantial is a matter of opinion, but a warning of the order of a year. That is, no country could effectively divert the plants in its territory or build new plants and get to work on atomic armament in less than a year from the time that you knew it had started on it. Well, that is not very long, but it is very long compared to minus a year. It is very long compared to minus a minute. It is very long compared to not knowing anything about it at all. And second, one would have the maximum full speed ahead development on a fully international basis of the constructive applications of atomic energy. And this is a point of some importance because at the moment, the country that knows most about it, the United States, at least I think we do, has the least need of it. The places where atomic power would probably make the greatest difference are just the countries which will be the last to have the technical resources and knowledge and skill to find it. That's in the nature of things, because in a country which has good transportation, highly developed industry, lots of coal, lots of oil, you don't need atomic power very badly. In a country which has none of these things, and above all, which has poor transport, you may need it desperately. And third, and this is the most important point, you would have made a start with an atomic development authority on a path which is a real pattern for international action. In my opinion, it is the easiest place to start because it is a place where you do not have to destroy any national patterns, any past ways of acting or organizing or thinking. But you would have started acting not as a group of nations protecting their national interests, but as a group of men committed to the welfare of mankind as a whole. And everyone knows that this is the point that we are aiming at. Everyone knows that only the unification of the world will take the curse of war from us. And also everyone knows that there has hardly been a time when this most urgent problem has been more difficult because of the differences in way of life, in belief, in political institution that exist in the world. And that is perhaps the main point. Namely, you would have made an opening wedge in the problem of national sovereignty. And this opening wedge you would not hold without fighting. You would find that time and again there would be pressure brought on you to reduce the power of the ADA and give the nations more voice in what was happening. But you could hold the wedge, I'm sure, if you could ever establish it, and you could expand it. There are other problems which, once this pattern were established, lend themselves very naturally. A World Health Authority, which might worry, incidentally, about the menaces of biological warfare, is only a minor example. Well, in essence, this proposal, not only in essence, but in detail, has been put forward by the United States. It has been supplemented by a logically separate proposal, the nature of which and the reason for which is not hard to explain. A year is not a very long time, and if you find out that country X on the 5th of May, 1955, has seized its atomic energy plants, you will be very uneasy and you will scrabble around a lot trying to get ready for the consequences before the 1st of May, 1956. And therefore, you would like to have every possible deterrent. Now, there is a deterrent in the situation already because very few powers are confident enough of victory and of their position in the world to declare a war. And this would be a declaration of war without the ability to use surprise in a military sense. And that would be the situation. But you can ask whether it is not possible to increase the deterrence by the organization of sanctions. And here I am talking not of the kind of administrative regulation which you may need in order to see that mines are operated right, or factories, but the kind of thing that you might have to do if a nation, in all seriousness, indicated that it was on the warpath. And it was the thought of the United States representative to the Atomic Energy Commission, Mr. Bruch, that it would be nice if such a situation arose, it would be fine if you could count on all the powers to gang up on that one and take a pre-agreed action. And therefore he proposed that not only with regard to the administrative regulations of atomic energy, but also in the problem of sanctions, there be a waiver of the right of unanimity in the Security Council. Well, I think everyone would agree that the results were desirable. Everyone would agree that it was desirable that if there were major violations of atomic energy agreements, which were clearly headed for war, that all the powers that had not so violated the agreement would pounce on the violator and make it unattractive. I am somewhat doubtful. However solemnly the nations commit themselves to such action, whether, if a situation arises in which war is about to break out, those commitments will be honored. And I am also somewhat doubtful whether the right of a power to veto war being made on it will have much effect on whether war is made on it. Therefore, I think these are important proposals, but they are not as important as the establishment of a genuine internationalization. Well, I wanted only to say a word of that, because my feeling is that although one must be prudent and must worry about what would happen if these plans collapse, if they get into effect and then they are turned down, or if someone tries to evade them, or if war breaks out, the real point to concentrate on is that in setting up a proposal of this kind, one will have taken such an enormous step toward the unification of the world that it will not happen that these proposals, that these provisions will be violated. It will not happen that war will break out. Now, the very fact that one attaches so much importance to this step indicates that more is at stake than atomic energy alone. The very fact that this is the beginning of a unification of the world indicates that although the unification may, and in my opinion should, start at this point, because there are peculiar advantages to the problems of atomic energy which do not exist anywhere else, nevertheless, the fact that you are going in for this will have effects on all of your international policy and the development of international controls in the field of atomic energy is not, in a political sense, separable from the whole orientation of international policy. I did not mean to say that. I meant only that this is the area in which this specific, radical, and to my mind, heroic action is possible. Now, it is necessary to admit that the talk I have given would have been more appropriate, let us say, 4 months ago, because as you have read in the newspapers, and as in deep fact is true, the discussions in the United Nations Atomic Energy Commission, which has been entrusted with the solution of this problem, have been deadlocked, and they have been seriously deadlocked. It is possible to believe, and it would be comforting to believe, that the unwillingness of the Soviet government to entertain proposals along these lines rests on their not understanding fully what we have in mind, on their supposing that it would do them more harm than is, in my opinion, true, and do them less good than is, in my opinion, true. And for that reason, one must welcome the fact that the Commission has spent its last months in essentially a campaign of discussion and education, which, on certain levels, the levels of the scientists, has had a measure of success. It would also be comforting to believe, and very attractive, that the reason for the Soviet reluctance is that there are minor details of our proposals on the matter of when we make bombs and on the matter of the veto and so on, which may or may not be acceptable to them and which are causing the difficulty. I wish I could encourage this view, either of these views. I just don't know that the evidence is against it. And the evidence is that the deadlock goes to the much more serious matter of the internationalization of atomic energy as principle. I don't know. But I would say two things. One is that it has taken a very long time for the United States to come to the position it now holds, and it may take time, and it may take a very close coordination of our policy in the domain of atomic energy with our policy in other matters before there can be any hope of agreement with other nations in the world. And the second is perhaps the more important thing. I would like to come back again to the simple fact that there is a very far-reaching parallelism between the constructive and the warlike uses of atomic energy. Because of this, the problem of what we in this country are to do can largely be separated for the time being from the outcome of the negotiations between this country and the other powers. We have the same job of the healthy, vigorous, free, imaginative development and exploitation of this field, whether there is going to be atomic war and we have to be prepared for it, or whether there is going to be an ADA. If there is going to be an ADA, we're going to have to take the major part in pushing it over the top. And the only way to do that is to get started on the work now. If there is not going to be an ADA, we will have the very terrifying problem of trying to maintain ourselves so unattractive to attack that we will not be attacked. I don't know whether this can be done or not, but we'll have to try it. But the point that I would make is that the recently appointed Atomic Energy Commission in the United States, created in accordance with the McMahon bill, that this commission has just the same kind of job on a domestic scale that the ADA would have internationally, a job of rapid, imaginative, in the human and in the technical sense, imaginative development of a new field, with an eye to atomic weapons and with a fervent hope, and I am sure that you can count on them to be dedicated to that hope, that these weapons may never be used in anger and for the destruction of man. I forgot to say that in a subject like this, where, as I know, you know everything I've said and I haven't answered the things that you really wanted to hear, it's only right that I should attempt to answer your questions. Most of them I won't be able to answer.
I think we can all agree, after having heard Dr. Oppenheimer, that if we could only get the kind of thinking, the kind of thought process that goes on in a physicist's mind when he has a problem to solve, if we could get that into our international affairs, into some of our diplomats, it might help. Dr. Oppenheimer said they'd be glad to answer any questions, and I will pause for a moment to let those who have to leave depart, and then we'll go on.